then the subject universal ethics basis for decision making. It's an intensely practical subject. Besides being a very important part of one of the objects of the theosophical movement, which was ushered in the last century by Madame Blavatsky. Initially, the three objects were not very clearly dictated. But later on, it should be decided that a very clear-minded objects, if it is presented, then it is possible to pursue theosophical movement in a spatial way. Because this movement is a spatial movement which was ushered in at an appropriate time when men needed. So because of that, she started with the first object being to form a nucleus of universal brotherhood. That universal brotherhood has to be formed, but it has to start with a nucleus, because nucleus is an influential part of the cell. So like the cellular nucleus, it creates a tremendous influence around itself. So to begin with, to bring together like-minded people to create this kind of an influence. And to fulfill that object, she added two more objects. The second object, which she found to be necessary because, we'll see what it is, because she found that the people who could not be brought together because their religions or their, what is called the sectarian nomination religions were dividing people from man to man. Therefore, she emphasized on the second object. And it is found in two or three places, but we have taken this from the glossary of theosophical terms. The second object of the Theosophical Society is the serious study of the ancient world religions, philosophies and sciences. What is the purpose? For the purpose of comparison and selection therefrom of the universal ethics. So the emphasis is on the universal ethics. You can select only a special thing by making comparative study of religions, something that appeals to you. But the point is, ultimately you will have to arrive at universal ethics, besides many other things. And in Worldly Prompter No. 1, written by SPB, this is an article by Madame Blavatsky, What Are the Theosophies, in which she says, and those principles regarding this universal ethics are those of theosophy, not because they were uttered by the Christian Christ, but because they were universal ethics and were preached by Buddha, Confucius, Krishna, and all great sages. That is the central teaching of all world religions should be this, arriving at universal ethics. And therefore she adds further on that they were the common property of the great initiates of all ages. A common property. By property, it means a common denominator among them. This is the central theme of all world religions, to bring about universal ethics. It is, if this is the basis, this is the foundation for a religious life, or for a spiritual life. Never said religious, spiritual life. For a religious life. We can make a difference between the two later on. But as a foundation of a religious life, what is essential and the first step towards it is ethics. And what kind of ethics? Not the sectarian ethics, ethics which is propounded by the local sects, or pedestrian ethics, or what is called the Vyavaharic ethics. So with this background, we'll now go to the subject proper. That when we say universal, we must define it in the first place. The word universal and the word ethics. The word universal, by through definition through dictionary as well as through study, it appears to be, means having a scope as vast as universe. That is one definition. Universal means whole system, as against local or particular. Universal as against particular. Universal religion therefore means as against sectarian religion. And then another definition, applicable to all situations. And ethics which is applicable to all situations can be called universal. And can call it, Emmanuel Kant, you see that is the reading in your hand which tells you. On the next page, two things, on the top paragraph, two things fill me with wonder and awe and astound me. The starry heaven above and the moral law within. Moral law within. This is the definition of universal ethics. This is a categorical imperative. That is absolute. There is no going back of it. There is no challenging it. It's not hypothetical, therefore universal. So, Immanuel Kant, the Western philosopher, comes to this conclusion that that can be and that should be a universal ethics which is categorical. There is no two words about it. It is in that sense. Now, with this background, we'll go to the definition of ethics. Now, ethics and morality has to be differentiated. Ethics, morals and moralities. In the dictionary you can find a lot of differences. We will rapidly go to it. Ethics as such is a moral philosophy. It is also called science or system of morals. And morals are defined as guiding principles of moral law or the rules or standards of approved behavior. So morals is approved behavior in a particular society. But ethics is a system or a science which takes into account, which inquires into the nature of right and wrong. Therefore, Western philosophers consider ethics as an inquiry into the nature of the highest good. What is the highest good for man? So Western philosophers, particularly starting with Socrates. This is the kind of inquiry they make. What is the nature of the highest good? Cosmically, universally, as well as applied to man. In Indian tradition, it is called Niti Shastra. Now, Niti, in a very local sense, it means mere behavior. So it is Shastra regarding behavior. But it is not as that. It is defined as of the nature of Swadharma, and inquiring into the nature of Swadharma, that is Niti Shastra. Being a Shastra, it doesn't tell you do's and don'ts. It tells you the high and the why of it. In fact, one of the important contributions of Theosophy is that it does not tell you do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. It doesn't give out a definite statements of dictum or canon of the churches. But it gives you a rational explanation of things. This is the beauty that appeals both to the mind and the heart of the student. If you study theosophy properly, you'll find that at every important statement, there is a corresponding explanation given out in the light of theosophy. In the light of theosophical teaching, the basic background, the scientific teaching of theosophy. Therefore, the appeal is first to the intellect of the man, and when it sinks into the consciousness, then it becomes spontaneous, and the heart also gives consent to it. The heart consent is necessary in any ethical action. But before that, the mind also must be convinced, intellectual. Therefore, a great pains has been taken by all the great teachers of theosophy, especially Mr. Judge and Mr. Crosby. They take a lot of pains in explaining as to the reason why of things. So with this as the background, now we come to this about the basis for decision making. Now what is the justification for our choices? How do you justify your choice? Especially in moral issues. Now look, we are dealing with the moral issues. We are not dealing with political issues. We are not dealing with social issues. We are not dealing with legal issues. But look, we are not compartmentalized all at the same time. So-called legal issues have also its shades of moral coloring to it. This student has read a book, he forgot the title of that book. It was written by a barrister in England. And he says, and he describes instances after instances where legal issues, according to the law of the land, it sounded to be correct decision. The justice that was done happened to be correct. But he goes into the ethical question to it. And therefore he shows that ethically it is not very sound. The witness in the decision that a legal man gives, a law keeper gives, may not always be ethically sound. Similarly, many of the social customs or social sanctions, as they are called, a society gives sanctions to it, traditionally accepted, need not have a real moral backing, although they are called moral. So many of the so-called moral rules are not necessarily truly moral. They may be purely social conventions. So as against this, we do require, see, we don't require an outside authority which tells you to do this or not to do this. What is called in Quran, the word. See, or what is known as the Mosaic law. It's called the law. Law means dharma. It should be accepted. Accepted literally, besides. Nobody accepted. Accepted literally, without applying your mind. Now, that is not required in coming to justification of an action. So, morally, what is right or wrong, to decide that. In every situation, whether social, legal, political, economic, or interpersonal, in any such issues, we have to take into account something other than that. That is the burden of today's talk, the basis for ethical decision. Now, actually, for any basic, you require knowledge. And what kind of knowledge? And that, of course, Kant also says that it requires essential nature of things, or what are called the first principles. He calls them first principles because you have to go into the very essence of the essential nature of things. You have to find out what is the nature of things. Whenever suppose you consider marriage. But then what marriage really means? You have to go into the essence of the meaning of the word marriage. What does it imply? Not only in terms of social convention or social beliefs, but what it actually is, in fact. So this is how, you see, you split that word, we go deep into the essence, the very spirit of that word. When you say marriage, you don't go into the literal meaning of the word, you go into the very spirit of the word. It is only when you split it into the very spirit, go into the very essence, and having grasped it, then you can make proper decision. So then when it is a question of divorces, to understand divorce, you understand the marriage covenant as to what is it that brought two people together and what is the essential meaning behind that marriage. Is it conventional or it is the very nature of things as far as human beings are concerned? Of course, it is traditional in the sense that there is an outward performances, but is there such a thing as an archetypal thing as marriage? Marriage between spirit and matter. This is really archetypal marriage between the two great forces. Right? That marriage means union in heart and in mind. So once you define it, you will be able to arrive at the conclusions which you can draw out of this. That's why we have to go back to the first principles. This is one of the exercises we have to undertake. Whenever we when you want to justify any action, justify or trying to explain what is right and what is wrong, not accepted traditionally, not merely by belief, but on the basis, and not on the basis of any authority whatsoever. No outside authority. Not even the words of Christ. Not even the words of Jesus. Or not even the words of Sri Krishna. You cannot quote Bible, or you cannot quote the Bhagavad Gita and say, oh, this is justified. You have to explain why. You have to give reason why. To give reason why, you have to go back to the very meaning of those words. So, as we said, there are a lot of traditional belief systems. But don't you see, these traditional systems, they keep changing because they are customary. And However time-honored, they may call time-honored, honored by time. However long they may be, sometimes they change, they have to change as the time changes. Not that the man changes, no. The time and the circumstance may change, so for the custom has to be changed. I don't know, even an external custom, even in a moral issue, even a moral issue which is customarily accepted, for instance, polygamy or monogamy. In a society, polygamy is treated as absolutely normal and healthy procedure. For instance, among the Egyptians, a brother and sister can marry. This is the tradition and it lasted for 1,000 years. Accepted. But you have to go behind the inner meaning of that marriage and the relationship between the two. So when you do that, when you split it in that sense, then only you can arrive at true meaning of ethics. So people have tried, this is in the Nitya Shastra, in our ancient literature, you come across Grahastha Dharma, Stri Dharma, Raja Dharma, Kshatriya Dharma. See, they are called dharmas, they are called the beauty of a king, beauty of a Kshatriya, beauty of a Grahastha, the husband, Stri Dharma. The beauty, if you are a woman, right, from childhood, as a sister, as a daughter, as a sister, as a wife, as a mother. So as a woman, what is the function? So that, what are you made for? What are you essentially? When I say woman, we mean womanhood. Huh? We don't only mean the woman's body or the feminine nature. We mean the true womanhood in its essence. Then if you see the function of a true womanhood, then you will know what are her real functions. Should she be merely limited to kitchen work, or she can participate shoulder to shoulder with men in worldly matters? Could she or could she not? Yes, you could, because this feminine quality, this womanhood, can aid in the social functions. So in that sense, there is some kind of an equality between man and woman, because she contributes in herself. Here, you have only one instance about it. To that extent, her contribution to the advancement of society is necessary. She doesn't add her femininity to it. She adds a female nature, the womanhood, what it means, mystical. So like that, since Grahastha Dharma, Stri Dharma, they are only words, but they are deeper. And when they were taken up by the great philosophers of yoga, they were really taken up with great seriousness, and people used to give, I mean, they are sanctified. They are sanctified because they have threadbare understood the essence of things. Now with this background, otherwise what happens is still merely traditionally you go into the rut, as one of the writers said. You merely go into the rut of believing and behaving in a particular way for thousands of years without question. And then, see, the mind becomes passive. It may be said that this kind of superstitious beliefs, etc., leads to mental suicide. It is actually a mental suicide because you abdicate your right as a thinker, as a manushya. So that doesn't mean that you can think what you like, but thinking on certain fundamental principles. Those fundamental principles now we are going to do. So how to arrive at decisions and choices in those moral issues, we have to take into consideration. First of all, you have to take into consideration what are the faculties we are using. See, are we choosing things impulsively? Are you merely doing it instinctively? This motivation psychology tells you that you are motivated by your needs, biological needs. Yeah, you marry because you are biologically male partner. Or you go to work and you must earn your livelihood because you want to fill your stomach. So for security's sake, for the sake of your production, you require this. So this is purely a biological and psychobiological needs of man. So this is how motivation psychology limits us. So are we motivated only by those things? The wise people say that we are motivated by two things. That which is prayers and that which is prayers. Prayers is that which is dear to us, priya. That which is accepted to our senses, which pleases our senses, which is pleasing to our senses, which is pleasing to our heart. So that Hemingway once humorously said that I like to go and see this bull fights. because it gives me a sense of pleasure. But afterwards it makes me feel sad. It gives me a sense of pleasure, so it is right, according to him. In much of his writing he justifies this bullfight. But in his later writing he says, I feel sad. So he goes by emotions. What is right is that which pleases me. What is wrong, which is not pleasing. Mr. Judge corrects him, no. Right is that action which is pleasing to Ishwara. Oh my goodness. And the yardstick of Ishwara. Now how are you going to bring Ishwara in the game? If I have quarrel with my wife and I tell you that this is the right thing, how to bring God in as a witness, in the witness box? How to do about doing it? This is the real difficult situation. That means you must be conversant as to what really the inner man, the inner divinity wishes for you. What it wishes for you or in particular. So what is right for one man may not be right for the other. For this incarnation, it is right for me to behave in that particular fashion. It is for this way, these four varnas, Kshatriya, Vaishya, etc., Brahmin, etc., these four classes, set aside. It is because it is the very nature of things that they needed. In that sense, they were sacrosanct, they are proper. At present, since there is a mixture of these qualities, it cannot be always applicable. This will be by one instance. So how we justify that Brahmin must always be a Brahmin or Kshatriya must always be a Kshatriya? Need not be. You must have a Kshatriya quality in you. Then only you have to be a Kshatriya. Now you can justify it in terms of quality. Just as I told you about that womanhood. It's a quality that ultimately decides the decision making. So for that you require discriminating faculty. You don't go by impulse, nor even intellect. Intellect guides you, very smart. Intellect is very cunning. This is where you see, there is a quotation on that, of course. The much, much loaded mind is not the final judge. It's the third quotation. The much loaded mind is not the final judge. And that there are higher faculties which may be exercised for the acquirement of knowledge and for application to decision making. So what are those other faculties which we require? What we call the buddhi faculty, the faculty of discrimination. Now, see, the other day we came across a school children's book, a very funny story, that there were three fishes. They were very good friends staying in a lake, a big lake. And one of the fishes heard the fisherman saying that tomorrow we'll come to this lake and catch these fishes. And we find, oh, there are so many fishes in this lake. So tomorrow we are going to come. So when that chap heard it, he was a very wise fish. He went and told his two friends. And he went and told everybody else, of course. But he told, and especially his two friends. The second friend was a very smart and intelligent fellow. Oh, we'll see when it comes. I will tackle it. The third fish says, Hona hai toh hone do. Whatever is going to happen, is going to happen. Submissive. So these three qualities are there, the passivity, the intellectual pursuit, and there was the wise thing. The wise fish told him, no, please listen, this is a warning sign. At least I am going away to the next lake, because there is already a pathway between the two. So she swam, and there were a few who followed her. The next day the fisherman came and caught the fishes. The smart fish acted as if it is dead, because he saw that the fisherman, when he was taking them out, he used to throw back the dead fish into the lake. So he said, oh, that's nice. He acted as a dead fish and he was thrown back. Thereby he was saved. The other chap who was passive, unfortunately lost his life. Now this is the lesson to children telling that there is wisdom in healing to the warning. Provided it is the true one, by the way. You see, if there is an alarm, and which there is the real alarm, then one has to heed it properly. You know, first thing is, when you are really given a warning, why are you going to think intelligently? Why apply your mind? You can, of course, when emergency comes. When emergency comes, of course, you must apply your mind. But there also you must apply your wisdom. Supposing if there is a small room and a fire takes place. Everybody in the theater, people go on a stampede, they kill each other. In that stampede, sometimes there are many people are injured or even dead because of their unnecessary rushing. A wise fellow will actually not only keep his mind cool, but will guide people as to this is the outlet, this is a better outlet, this is the way you must do it. And he has got the knowledge, he says that when the fumes come up, you go down on your knees, because he has got the first knowledge. So like that, he keeps his mind cool. This is the mark of a wise man. He never loses his cool, because he knows that he is going to wriggle out of the situation, but first he has to help people. His instinct is not to run. So not instinctually to rush to the decision. Not really applying intelligence, but to apply this kind of the lesson of the heart, the message, the wisdom of the heart. Therefore, in decision making, it is better to consult the heart sometimes. In doubt, it's better to consult the heart. That's why Sajjan Jat sometimes says that if the heart melts and if you want to give charity, do it at once. It's spontaneously. Although it may not go away sometimes. Afterwards, you will apply your mind and you find that it may have often gone waste. So apply your mind also. And thereby you create intuitive perception. You will be guided from within as to the judgment of people. This judgment is not an intellectual judgment. It means impulsively. From within you will know, yes, this is the right person to give. And you will do it. Provided your heart melts often enough, then this gift comes out in you to be able to judge people well. So this faculty of discrimination is called buddhi, or buddhi faculty, which is a very higher faculty and the inner guide that is mentioned there. But then in man, that is what is called the moral sense, which is inherent to man, which is ingrained in us, which is what history calls burnt down into our very fabric of our nature. When man became a thinking man, he not only became a thinker in his own rights, as against animal kingdom, not only became a chooser in that sense, because he had now the free will to choose, but he had inherent in him certain ideas so impressed on him that they cannot die. No matter of amount of materialism, no amount of sensuality will completely kill out in the most sensuous man, in the most materialistic man. This little thing will always remain, the whispering of buddhi to him. This whisper will be there, at least at the dying hour. At least at the dying hour. It has to be there. So it will never die out, because it has been imprinted upon our very consciousness itself. Now this is the faculty, if we can exercise it now and then. Allow it to answer from behind us. It is called the whispering of buddhi to manas, in a technical sense. But it is actually a kind of an impulse, which is a higher impulse, which tells you to do it. So that you find that, supposing, you always find girl children, they are always somehow or other modest about themselves. The modesty in girls comes spontaneously, naturally. These students have seen it with little girls. Modesty comes to them naturally and spontaneously. Boys are boys, after all. This ruffian quality of boys is their natural impulse. But the girls have got that quality of that protecting that chastity. So this is the exercise which has to be cultivated. If it is there in us, and it has to be endowed in us. Now, as we just now said, that as to the value, there is a very fine statement in the Bible that how does it profit a man if you were to gain the whole world but suffer the loss of your own soul? Now here is the value judgment. Two values. You gain the whole world on one side, but here you have suffered the loss of your soul. Nobody wants to sit down and think on this, that I am getting a profit out of this business. But at what cost? At the cost of defiling my nature. A little shadow entered into my soul. A little darkness has poured into it. I have made it impure to little extent. At every time you have failed in a little while, we have not only made ourselves impure, but to that extent we have affected others also. But I have made defile myself. So that this is the value of judgment. What is pure, what is the right thing to do? This is a profitable thing. Yes, but there is a greater profit in preserving my soul. So the value of my soul, and when we talk about the soul, this is what we are now going to come to, the fundamental principle. The first principle is that man is in essential nature a spiritual being. That life of a man is actually the life of the soul, it is not the external life. Although the external life is given to him as a vehicle, as a kind of kshetra, through which his soul can be exercised. The soul can achieve and his spiritual muscles in this battlefield of life. It is only when he is given this opportunity in a human body that he can exercise his mind, body and his intelligence. So how are we going to use our higher faculty unless it is given an opportunity, and life offers opportunity. So this moral sense has to be exercised. And when the more and more it is exercised, the more and more it develops in it. So that some people are highly sensitive in their moral sense. See, they are very finicky ones sometimes. Of course, some people are very neurotic about it also. A neurosis is people who are exaggeratedly keeping themselves clean and pure. Exaggerated purity, as far as bodily purity I am talking about, is an exaggerated, they fear, even if they fear God so much that they become neurotic. We are not talking about that. We are talking about the real inner sensitivity. So a person is sensitivity, keeps his mind cool and is calmly true to his own nature. Because his own nature in essence is spiritual, because he has recognized it. That I am not this person, I am not this outer personality. That it is given to me as a vehicle for a particular purpose. That I am going to use this, I am going to preserve this vehicle, of course I am not going to destroy it. But not at the expense of my soul. So that if it is worth dying, let me die. This value judgment sometimes comes spontaneously. It happened, you see, when two friends, they were sailors, when the ship sank and they were both drowning, they both caught hold of a wooden plank. And one of them impulsively thought, he says, look, you have got your family to look after. I only want mother to cry after me. I am going, bye. He left it and drowned himself. On the spot he decided that this man's life is more valuable because there are so many people who live on him. Whether he was looking after his wife, looking after his mother and looking after his children. Whereas I am all alone, I got only one mother to cry after me. And this friend remembered him and looked after his mother later on. Now this is the thing, that on the spot, this decision making on the spot comes because if you are by nature and character, we are arousing you this moral sense more frequently than ever. So this, therefore, the guiding principle, therefore, what is good and what is right, if we want to make it. Good is that which comes from within, which appeals to our higher sense, which appeals to our true nature. Then we go to this quotation and there, the fourth quotation, philosophy seeks to reconcile all sects and people under a common faith, this common basis. What is that? Namely, belief in one supreme eternal power governing the universe by the immutable eternal law. Now, look at the whole government of the universe by that one eternal law, which is God. That is, God is none other than that law. Because the only way by which you and I can get the evidence, if you want to show the evidence, there are only two things, as Kant said. The starry heaven, it means that the very law of this heaven. When you look at heaven, when you look at the sky, when you look at it, they are functioning under tremendous laws of which we have no knowledge about. How the starry heaven is functioning. But we know intuitively, and science also conveys it, that it is functioning under the natural law. So that is, the whole universe is supported by a dharma. Dharma means law. That which holds it by that law. And therefore, this is the evident proof that there is, and besides that, that law is an intelligent law. You arrive at not only the fact of law, but the fact of an intelligent law. So this is the way by which you arrive at it, that since the universe is governed and guided by law, there is a law of my own very nature. The law of my nature is that I must behave like a human being, truly human. And therefore, Aishwarya said that to be truly human means spontaneously charity, justice and generosity should come to us naturally. And if it does not come to us, we are no better than genus of animal. Superior genus of animal, she says. We are no better than superior genus of animal. No wonder science classifies us as animals. Social animals, they call us. We are not only social animals. We are human beings as physical, but in an inner sense, we are in essential nature, we are souls who have come here as adventurers, as learners, as students, as warriors, and on the stage of life, as actors. So this is Captain Byron, this is again and again theosophical position. You see, you will find that almost in every lecture, the emphasis is the essential nature of man. The man in his essential nature is spiritual. And how can you live your essence? It happened to one of the mystic Sufi. He was crossing a river, and as he was about to cross, he came across a scorpion who was struggling in water. So he picked it up, and the scorpion bit him, so he had to drop it. Further on, he found the scorpion. He again picked it. Second, third time till he reached that other side. By that time, the scorpion has given so much poison that he was almost dying. He fell. The other people said, "You fool, don't you know the nature of scorpion? Its nature is to bite you." I said, "And how can I live my nature? My nature is to preserve. I always like to help. I always like to save life." So this, when things like this can become a second nature, become a part and parcel of our true nature, which is not only spiritual, it is the human nature. Charity, justice and generosity is natural and spontaneous in human beings. Should be. So in that sense, our true nature, therefore, is to save. Because this is the whole universe, is one universal principle of life, out of which we have all come. That we are all the sparks of that divinity, of that one life. Each one a unit of life, a spark of life. And therefore, we have to respect life. So that's why we tell our children, particularly Dalai Lama. See, you will come across, if you read Dalai Lama very frequently, he will always use this one matter. He always tell people that, see, don't you think you like to avoid pain? He tells even politicians, don't you think all human beings always like to avoid pain? Don't you think human beings always like peace, like to live in peace? Don't you think human beings always like to find and seek happiness within their own circle? That human desire is to seek peace and avoid pain. This is a chavi with which you solve all problems. Solve all political, legal, moral problems. In political dealing, you see, how am I going to injure that party? And how am I going to preserve my happiness at the cost of somebody's pain? Is it right and proper? Measure. Of the two needs, which is better? As they said, that for the sake of many, one can be sacrificed. Now, this is purely a value judgment. But there are intelligent people who can even save that fellow also. There is a way of saving even that. Why sacrifice that for the sake of many? So this is a very tricky decision making. But to children we can always tell them. So the golden rule, of course, there is a very good quotation is that golden rule is given. It is called the golden rule in the Bible. It's the last quotation, the first page. Universal brotherhood is that which results in doing unto others as you would have them do unto you, and is loving your neighbor as yourself. There are two things. Declared as right by all teachers in all the great religions of the world. Now this is the Mahavakya we might say. This is Mahavakya. This is the essential way of animal. And further on says that the same Matthew says that these are the words of the Prophet and the law. This is the words of the Prophet and the law. This is a fundamental law. What? Do unto others as you would love them. That means put yourself into the shoes of another and then do it. If you want to find out how should I behave in that particular Put yourself in that person's place. Now, this is one thing very nicely can be used for children. When you want to teach children, this is a very nice way of saying. When two children call you, tell them, how do you feel if this were to happen to you? You have slapped that person. How do you feel if that person has done the same thing to you? At once the child's eyes opened, yes, but I felt very uncomfortable when this thing were to happen to me. Therefore, I should not do it to another. So, do unto others is a very simple, straightforward way of finding out as to how we must live in interpersonal relations. Very simple, but very profound. And that's what is the Dalai Lama has been using it very frequently. He says, come on now, look, put yourself in the shoes of another feet. Don't you think that fellow also seeks happiness? Don't you think that fellow also wants to avoid pain like you? Then why inflict pain on another? Why don't you give him a little bit of happiness if it's possible to do it? By giving yourself a little bit of pain. Now, this is a kind of a, taking one other step forward, that by giving yourself a little suffering, by giving up. Because it is your nature to be charitable, just, and generous. So likewise, these are the little tricks you can play in decision making. And it is not very difficult. In very profound life situation, I mean, see, in the light of theosophy section, and also in the section of question and answer, if you go to last so many years, you will come across this common thing. A question that comes up because a very tricky situation, an issue is placed before the questioner. And the questioner goes back to the first principle and says, alright, in the light of theosophy, the fundamental principles, if you apply this in this particular situation, things become very clear. It will answer your problem. So that in this particular situation, is divorce right or wrong? In this particular situation, polygamy right or wrong? Even Harakiri and Sati has been once upon a time sanctioned for a very proper and right reasons in those days, at least. Because in that society, it was proper. It was the way of life for them. It was a courageous thing to die for Sati, to give herself for the sake of her beloved. In the same way that Harakiri that was performed by the leader, the commander of an army, when he gets himself defeated. Of course, in the present war, you see the great commander says, oh, no Harakiri here. You have to preserve the life of that commander so that even if the whole army dies, so long as he is preserved, he will be useful to the nation. So here the value. He is useful to the nation because he has his pound, shilling and pence values. Yes, he is. Whereas a proud Japanese will say, no, I have lost my battle, because of me they have life. Therefore I should also die. See, this is a value judgment. So even Harakiri in some sense has a value. It's a kind of a suicide, but it is an honorable suicide. We are not allocating it, but we are just saying the principle behind this, the feeling behind it. When a man performs Harakiri, the feeling behind him is he's proud of his nation. I have failed my nation. I have no right to survive. And he kills himself. Similarly, a Sati. So like that, there are things which are obnoxious in one sense. This can have its place if you look at into the very spirit of the nation. So another thing is, another very important thing, there's only few times that you can say, compassion is the basis of all knowledge. So this is another thing. Allow your heart to function. In case of decision making, if that is one of the two things, better to let go. Better I sacrifice and let that person benefit. Because in that quarrel, if two people keep on quarreling, they will go to the court, they will go to the law court, and both of them will suffer. Ultimately one may succeed, but it will always leave a bitter taste in that person's mouth. And in the mouth of the man who is defeated, as the Bhagavad Gita says, the man who is defeated will cry. And the victorious people will be always afraid, lest it may again come back. And so the victorious fellow also is a hatred in his heart. The fellow is defeated will always brood with hatred. And therefore in the warfare, hatred will increase by hatred. But there is a profound law. That law, that it is only by love, by compassion, you can solve it. So it is better to heal on the side of compassion. Ultimately when the choice comes, it is better to let go and heal on the side of compassion, heal on the side of generous nature. I be on the side of generosity. although I may be a defeated man, publicly, politically, legally, I may be defeated. But I have been generous, I love that person like that. Let go for the sake of peace. Because peace is very precious. If you value peace, then you let go many of these quarrels. Quarrels end soon. Wise people end their quarrels. So, we can go to the very last quotation before we end. There are about 3 minutes. It is in the life on the path. Eternal harmony is the law of life. Discord of his opposite is his shadow. Whence spring suffering? It is out of this discord spring suffering. This suffering is the teacher. It is the awakener of consciousness. And therefore necessary. But why suffering? Why necessary? Why bring suffering? We can avoid it. So, eternal harmony is the law of life. Take up your questions. Conflict between the equality between man and woman, in essentially both are equal because both are souls in that sense. But functionally they are different. But that does not mean that a woman who is a mother has always to be a mother. She is also a human being. She must also have to exercise her other muscles, her other qualities. She may have a very powerful intelligence. And why should that intelligence be neglected? Allow her to fructify that intelligence in her. She may have a warrior nature. Why not have the warrior nature allow it to get fructification? Because to that extent she is contributing to the welfare of her society. So don't compartmentalize just because she has a woman's body that she has placed only in the kitchen. It was proper in those days, as you said, the man was a hunter and the woman had to look after children, and there were many, many children in those days. So in that sense, naturally she had to be all the time busy with children. There hardly any time to hunt. So properly, therefore there was a proper, what is called the distribution of labor. Proper, exact. In some families it is proper that a woman should remain at home. It is really proper. Sometimes children are neglected if the woman goes to work and the man, husband, wife, both goes to work. You will find that children are neglected. Definitely. Unless there is some grandmother or grandfather or somebody, a good nanny, truly looks after them. So mother's place is at home, truly. But that doesn't mean you confine her within the whole world. So don't be very rigid about those laws. One has to be very adjustable, and in each case and each instance, therefore there should not be a do's and don'ts about it. Go into the very spirit of it. In this particular instance, this particular situation, the woman herself should decide that no, my now place is in the home. I have done enough job. Now I must... We have seen women who have done service in the early years because they had to support the husband. But later on they found their husband not earning well enough. They have resigned. And therefore they have come back and looked after their home. Voluntarily, knowing that yes, my home needs me more than office work. So, but this comes from within. So long as you consult the heart, or after the time, if you consult the heart and really are judgmental, really, really generous in your judgment, then you will allow certain place, both equality and equality.